This is Meredith for Real, the Curious Introvert, and I'm Meredith. Here we explore taboo questions through nuanced conversations. Sometimes they're questions people think but don't ask out loud, and sometimes they're questions that fly under the radar, veiled by cultural hypnosis. My mission, and yours if you choose to accept it, is to inspire curiosity within yourself and the world around you. Each episode is different, so bring your ADD and your earbuds and have a look around. If you're a regular, you may have already noticed this isn't my regular voice. I'm a little under the weather, but don't worry, this episode was recorded when I was in perfect health. Today's episode explores both the reported benefits and precautions of plant medicines, specifically ayahuasca and psilocybin. Around 25 minutes in, my guest answers listener Q&As. So if you are in my private Facebook group and asked a question, that's where you'll likely hear it. And if you end up liking this episode, you'll also like the one I did on the more academic side of this conversation. It was with a clinical psychologist and professor at UAB researching psilocybin as a cure for addiction. That's episode 160. All right, friends, keep it curious. This is the time of year where resolutions go to die. Promises of therapy, yoga, dry January are just extra notches in the belt of self-disappointment. My next guest was planted firmly and chronically in the middle of all of this, a middle-aged guy from the Midwest in the middle of socially acceptable bad behavior. You know, the kind of addictive activities that are common enough that no one's concerned, but severe enough that you don't like yourself. After selling a successful business, a series of serendipitous events led him to researching ayahuasca as a healing modality for trauma. The experience was so healing, he never returned to the rat race or to his compulsions. Now he coaches others on how to properly and responsibly use psychedelics to heal trauma and addiction. Today, he's going to answer the questions that we're all thinking, but too afraid to Google, as we explore the question, could psychedelics heal trauma for good? Microdose mentor, community builder, practical psychonaut, Matt Simpson. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Meredith, for that gracious introduction.
For the uninitiated, ayahuasca is unpleasant. It's like a multi-day, muggy, buggy event where you circle up with strangers and puke your guts out. And so it's not like, you know, rainbows and unicorns. So what were you hoping to get out of that experience when you signed up for it?
Freedom. I was so stuck. I was so stuck in a toxic business relationship, stuck in the rat race, and did not see a way out. I had had success and with psilocybin on a recreational basis and some therapeutic value there. And I'd started meditating, and I was in a really tight position where I just sold my business, and I had this 1 week before I was going to be onboarded with the new business, new company. And I was going to be so soaked up about, or sucked in by the responsibility and the money and esteem and golden handcuffs, so to speak. And I took a flyer. I took a chance to fly down to Costa Rica for ayahuasca. And I was searching for freedom from my maladaptive behaviors, from my drinking, from my toxic relationships, from this relentless rumination that I had at the time, depression, again, drinking very heavily at that time. Yeah, seeking for freedom.
You said in one of your solo podcast episodes on your podcast that ayahuasca has also been an experience that has created a lot of problems for you, but I don't think you elaborated on that. Can you explain how it's created some problems also?
Yeah, they're good problems to have. Dissonance that you know, I think that when we have this healing ritual and we're doing it in a foreign country, the depth of love can be so, so extreme. And then when we come back to integrate that into our day to day, it's going to have us really challenge some of our conditional relationships. And that can be problematic. The integration process can be very challenging. That's why I wrote a 308-page psychedelic integration program, because I struggled so much.
So are you saying there's maybe a right and a wrong way to do psychedelic medicine?
It's just a warning to people that sometimes we can go too deep And then that can be really, really challenging when we're integrating that back into the busy day to day. And yeah, we want to do our healing. We want to clear traumas. We want to be healthy, happy, and strong, but being also realistic to how we are spending our time in the end of the day to day and the world that we're going to have to come back to.
That's so major. I could really see that being a problem. Like, I don't know, nihilist is definitely not the right word, but if there's like a psychedelic version of nihilism where you're like, nothing matters, everything, you know, everything's love, then it would make you like no good.
I saw a lot of that, and it was very disconcerting, you know, to see that and to see a lot of people that were peeing and moaning and whining about the same challenges and the same problems. In the introduction, you said, I think, practical psychonaut. I love that. And it caused a lot of problems. I saw that create, because then we're in this bubble of groupthink. There's groupthink, there's dogma on that side of the fence too. And then you're hanging out with people that share your same beliefs and you're getting encouragement. And then you have this kind of manic bubble. So to be mindful of our intention, why are we embarking on this sacred journey? What do we hope to accomplish? And to hold tightly to that intention, which is typically of healing and deepening our spiritual connection and you know, perhaps a journey of self-exploration, et cetera.
But all of those things are very esoteric to the person that, like yourself, comes from, you know, Chicago, fast pace. You know, like, you're just speaking another language. And I could see where they would feel very, oh, I don't know, just almost like overwhelm, almost like whiplash. And so that's kind of where you come in as a coach. Can you kind of describe, maybe you can use an example of like a real person that you've worked with in order to paint a picture of how you work with clients?
Yeah, I'd be delighted to. I launched my coaching business with my book back on Valentine's Day of 2019. So I've been doing this empowerment coaching, psychedelic integration coaching. I'm a microdose mentor for the last 5 years. Really about 3 years ago, I shifted my focus towards microdosing. I was seeing everybody was coming to me for microdosing. I was seeing this because we have this massive cultural phenomenon right now of people engaging these medicines and maybe not going to the full high dose because of the barrier of, hey, it's thousands of dollars to fly down to Costa Rica or Peru. And so this is, you know, having the microdosing is a lot more accessible. A case study: Alicia was drinking 12 cups of coffee per day and having a hard time getting out of her own way. The microdosing really helped harmonize. That's a word that I did not have in my lexicon 2 to 3 years ago. And I'm saying it every single day. And I absolutely love it that microdosing, and stacked with these practices of meditation and mindfulness and contemplative journaling and a commitment to exercise, we can harmonize our imbalances, harmonize our addictions.
So when you say, I've never worked with like a mindset coach, so forgive me audience, if you're like, duh, Meredith, why don't you know? I don't know, guys. I don't know. Are you, you know, exchanging text messages with these folks every day? Do you have one-on-one Zoom meetings? What does coaching actually look like in the very practical sense?
I guide 10-week magic and microdosing mentorship programs. So we set really bold intentions on the front end. Why are we embarking on this journey? Why are you engaging my coaching? What defines our time together as a success? Why are you engaging arguably the most powerful medicine on earth? And then we have weekly 50-minute sessions where we unpack and get even more clear as to our intention, what's in the way, where are we leaking energy, how can we tighten that up? And then we leverage the boosted neural plasticity that these medicines foster and engender. And neural plasticity, you know, perhaps your audience doesn't know what that is, but it's our brain and our nervous system's ability to change to internal and external conditions. That is where the magic in psychedelics come from. And we all know behavioral change here in the West is very uncommon, but with psychedelics and microdosing, macrodosing, we have this boosted neural plasticity that makes that change a little bit easier. I so often hear from my microdosing clients, they can struggle better. They can do the hard thing that is necessary when we're seeking to get out of depression or to reframe a past hurt or a trauma or to reduce the anxiety that we feel or to harmonize an addiction, et cetera.
Do you have any pushback on the business side of things, coaching people on illegal substances. You know, like, let me create some context. An acquaintance of mine started a Mardi Gras crew for cannabis. It's La Crew de Cannabis. And so it's basically like a club that people get together and then they participate in a large parade a few times a year. And they don't sell cannabis, or certainly they don't toss it like beads out from the parade, although that would be super fun. It just having the name Crew de Cannabis restricted her from opening a bank account. Have you had any similar obstacles?
Zero pushback. I'm working with people that are often struggling with mental health. And for me, this is Dr. King's civil disobedience. And to this point, I haven't seen or felt any pushback at all. And, you know, I'm again holding the space for people to make these realizations, to heal their traumas, to, you know, the hallmark of microdosing of the experience is boosted mood and energy levels. So that can be very, very helpful to serve as a catalyst to help people, again, start moving back towards that path of passion and possibility.
A question I think everyone is thinking, but everyone is definitely too afraid to Google, is where are people getting these substances?
Well, we have a massive decrim movement that is happening in real time. It started with Oakland years back, or Denver. I decriminalized psilocybin. Oakland followed up. We've had seven or eight other metropolises, Washington, D.C., Detroit, Ann Arbor, Seattle, a few other cities in California, the great states of Oregon.
Are you talking about psilocybin in all those examples?
Plant medicines in general, yes.
Okay.
So they decriminalized. The law enforcement are spending all of their resources focusing on the people that are peddling the fentanyl. It's equating to 100,000 deaths of despair. I believe last year that was the last number I'd heard.
Okay. And there's also some pretty cutting edge research for breakthrough therapies in collaboration with like the FDA and MAPS for people that are really not getting benefits from traditional therapeutic modalities. Can you speak to that?
I'd be happy to. And before I do, I just would say to your audience, and I'm just going to put this out there, that when I work with somebody and they have that earnest aspiration to overcome depression or to reduce their anxiety or to reframe a past hurt or trauma, and they're committed to putting in the work and committed to this path and to this process and can make the big, bold commitment to coaching, I do provide the medicine. So it's, again, this
Wait,
is,
what?
I do, I gift the medicine. So I'm just going to put that out there.
You gift it.
Gift it. Yes.
Sorry, Matt, I'm going to ask some really dumb questions. So
no dumb questions. Yeah. All good. All good.
You're just mailing it.
Yes.
Isn't that a federal crash? Okay. Eyebrows. Wow. Well, that is really interesting. You definitely are on the cutting edge. You know, let's put a pin in the therapeutic thing, because this brings up a question one of my insiders asked on my private Facebook group. He wanted to know what the litigation potential was. He's Canadian. That probably is maybe outside the scope of what you are used to speaking to. But you mentioned decriminalization. Does that mean that from a litigation risk point of view, that people who are participating in your coaching services, receiving happy mail, that they are less likely to be prosecuted because of these criminalization trends across the U.S.?
You know, this is a different application of the same powerful medicine, and there are risks with legality. And I'm upfront with people. I do think that outside of legality, the biggest risks are the infinite potential benefits that are left on the table when people aren't working with a coach and maybe doing this. That's a little bit of a tangent, but yeah, there's risks. We're out towards this edge, and you know, the laws are the laws. We're on the cusp of some massive changes that we're going to talk about here shortly, with MDMA assisted psychotherapy being a very likely approved FDA cure for post-traumatic stress disorder, likely by August of 2024. And we're out towards this edge. We're in a mental health crisis, depression numbers, anxiety, trauma, suicide. All of these numbers are soaring, and these medicines can help people.
Oh, okay. Yes. Let's dive into those specifics. I didn't realize that the approval was this year, potentially, and that's just for MDMA. Can you explain in brief, like, the difference between MDMA and the other healing medicines that people might use in therapy?
Absolutely. Before I do that, I just want to say that Australia jumped the gun about 6 months ago. They have approved, their federal government has approved MDMA-assisted therapy and psilocybin-assisted therapy for mental health. Their clinicians are already doing this work, my understanding.
Wow.
So they've again jumped the gun. Typically, we're the ones making the first bold moves. So that's a really positive sign here that this is happening. And yeah, there's psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy is behind MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. But just a few weeks ago, MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, submitted their NDA and their data and their request to the FDA saying, hey, we have a cure for post-traumatic stress disorder and a novel treatment. They were awarded a breakthrough therapy by the FDA in 2017, and they're at the end of a very long race. They've been doing this since the mid-1980s, and we'll be finding out in the next 30 to 60 days whether this will be fast-tracked or not, but it's my understanding that there will be a decision by the FDA by August of 2024, and then at that point, they will be, if they approve it, they will have a few months to write a letter to the DEA and say, hey, this is no longer a Schedule 1. Schedule 1 meaning highly addictive with no therapeutic value. This is a medicine. Y'all need to reschedule this. This is happening.
Wow. Isn't that exciting? That's incredible. And certainly incredible for the aspects, the parts of the population that need it most, which you're very passionate about, who are our veterans.
Yes. 22 veterans that die by their own hand every single day. That number's likely closer to 40, and doesn't count the deaths of despair, drunk driving, all of the other maladies and other challenges that our veteran community has. And they're the ones, I believe, to push this edge. You know, I've been advocating for our veterans since 2017 to get healing with ayahuasca and plant medicines. And that's, as you know from reading my book, that's why I wrote the book, is to get this message of hope and healing out. I think our veterans are the ones to push this edge. If they can heal and get right after going to war and being in a real life hell, that's going to send a big signal to all of us to reframe all of our challenges and traumas and struggles. Our veterans are all leadership trained. They know honor, they know integrity, they know discipline. They just need medicines that work.
You know what the irony of this is? I'm sure this isn't lost on you, right? Is part of the reason that we have prohibitions on the substances that we do to this day is because when, in the US at least, they realized that it was causing people to not want to go to war and that it was not an effective interrogation truth serum, then they made it illegal so that, you know, the counterculture would slow down and that people would want to fight in wars and so that they could arrest specific populations. Isn't that so funny, though, that now the trickle down will be from the healing of the very people that went to some of those wars?
Yeah, ironic indeed. We're in a dire position. That community is in a dire position. Our collective mental health has never been more dire. And we respect and look up to our veterans. They're our brave warfighters and protectors. And when they do this healing, they're not afraid to raise their hand and say, hey, this is what I'm feeling. This is what I'm experiencing. And to share this and how this could potentially foster community resilience and to be a potential rallying point too. This is one of the few issues that brings the left and the right together. And it humbles both sides to have a very calm, grounded, conversation, a humanistic conversation. I was at the Psychedelic Science Conference in Denver, where 11,500 people came together in Denver for the MAPS Psychedelic Science 2023 conference. And to see the bipartisanship was so inspiring, to see Governor Rick Perry, you know, dressed in a suit and looking dapper as always, you know, very conservative Republican on stage with Rick Doblin and Jared Polis, the governor of Colorado, a gay man, and everybody there just in the spirit of brotherly and sisterly love of, hey, this needs to happen and we need to push this forward. We need to do what's right for our brothers and sisters that are dropping like flies to suicide in our veteran community. It was really inspiring to see that.
It is inspiring. Can you give a couple of examples, or maybe you can list a few areas that you've seen these medicines work? Like, what patterns are you seeing in terms of efficacy?
The most staggering is how quickly this can help harmonize addiction. I had a recent client, Tom, who was a veteran, drinking 30 drinks per week, and to have his desire to drink almost vanish overnight was awe-inspiring to see that. And then to have him go on a trip with friends and family, and to be able to have a few glasses of wine and to not have that his whole world come tumbling down, and to have this, you know, almost like we're expanding from what I affectionately call the bullshit incorporated limiting belief scarcity programs. And it's this $40 billion a year Western addiction recovery complex that says that we're either a neurotic sober person who hasn't dealt with his shit. We've all seen someone like that at a party who's just like, all right, well, that person's not drinking, but they certainly haven't addressed whatever was at the root, or this out of control derelict. And there's like, no, there's a lot of space in between. And harm reduction's really buzzy in this, in psychedelic spaces. And if having 2 to 4 drinks a week is certainly going to be a lot better for your health than 30. And if, you know, so again, to answer your question, the how these medicines harmonize addiction has been, again, awe-inspiring and astounding to me.
I love the way that you paint the picture of, we see, you know, two different people, two different candidates, like the derelict, the societal derelict, like out there, you know,
way out of control.
Yeah, out of control. And then the person who has trauma. But from reading your book, you are the perfect example of somebody that's really, like I said in the intro, you're in the middle of that. You had some very serious childhood trauma that you shared in the book went unaddressed. And then I would say partly just our popular culture mixed with the city that you're in, mixed with stress, mixed with the undealt trauma. I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong. All of that sort of equaled this lifestyle that was making you unhappy, but also, as you put it, kept you stuck.
Absolutely. Yeah. The trauma at the root of my dis-ease, that I believe affects 1 in 4 women and 1 in 6 men. Those numbers are likely far greater, as many people would rather blow their heads off than to actually utter these words that hey, this happened. And for me, that was a big part of my healing journey, was addressing this with my family at around, I don't know, I was at 30 or so, and I was, you know, in therapy and continually beating my head against the wall, having the same challenges, intimate challenges of connecting on a deep level, and this pattern of 3 painful breakups, you know, kind of the, what Katy Perry would say, the love bipolar. And it was just, it was so exhausting and so much pain. And my behavior was getting myself into a lot of trouble where I could no longer hide from that. And I had to come clean with that, and had to come clean with the childhood sexual trauma that was at root of my depression and my addiction and my materialism itis, and, you know, wearing a suit and thinking that I was better than everybody else, and pill popping and all of the maladaptive behavior that I had. And then to see and to do the research and to know that how pervasive this is, and was thinking, geez, Matt, if you're not going to step up and raise your hand and take a stand here, then no one else will. And I, as you know from my book, I take really big shots at the church, the Catholic Church specifically,
<You do.
laughs> that
Yeah.
I believe is at the, you know, and I'm going to tie this to our conversation around the veterans, that it was the 80 to 90% of our veterans that are healing in this modality with psychedelic medicines, that it's not the war trauma. It's the childhood sexual trauma time and time again. It is at the root that appears to be driving them to war in the first place. These are young men and women that have trauma, that are unable to connect with their tribe, their community, their loved ones, intimate partners, family, etc. So they're going off to war to find connection, to find tribe. Then when they come back, they don't have the family and the communities to absorb the trauma from war. And thus we have a veteran suicide tragedy and epidemic.
Hey, Curiositors, just a quick pause to show gratitude to our sponsors and give you some special deals.
If you're new here, you may be surprised to know that the beautiful backdrop of my show is not a virtual screen. It's a real place that you can really rent inside of the Pensacola Museum of History. The exhibit space is called Trader John's. It's an old bar in Pensacola whose owner was just as eclectic as this town. And it's perfect for birthdays, work events, award ceremonies, retirement parties, family reunions. So don't pick another boring venue space for your next event. Give the Pensacola Historic Trust your business and make your event super memorable. Learn more at historicpensacola.org. The weather is cooling down here in the southern U.S., and that means it's fire ant season. For those of you not from the south, fire ants are about as pleasant as they sound, and their bites pus up into an itchy red mess that takes forever to heal. I recommend InSec for pest management because I've been using their mosquito service since 2019, and I love that their work is guaranteed. If you're in the Florida Panhandle or the Gulf Coast of Alabama, give InSec a call. It's ENSEC.net. Now back to the show. Remember to stay till the end where I give you a sneak peek of next week's episode. Yeah, I never considered that. And I didn't know those stats, honestly, until I read them in your book. Because I know the stats about domestic abuse, 1 in 3 women, 1 in 4 men. And so, you know, weird fun fact about myself, sometimes when I'm in a crowd of people, I look around and I think, okay, yeah, 1 in 3 of these women and 1 in 4 of these men. But wow, that really adds a whole nother layer of it. I have some more questions from my listeners from that insider group, if that's okay to, because they asked some great ones and they were they're so excited to hear from you. So I'm just going to read them as they wrote them. One person says, is there a correlation to amount and personality types? I'm a control freak and don't like being out of my faculties. Would I need less or not be an ideal candidate at all?
For microdosing?
Psychedelics, I think they were saying.
Yeah. For microdosing, virtually anyone can microdose and find a sweet spot dose. So yeah, the microdosing can be catered towards that, you know, to, you know, perhaps dose on the lower end. It's a different experience from a phenomenology standpoint than the high dose experience. And yeah, the high dose experience is, hey, you know, it's, our heart's going to open, our mind's going to open, the curtains of our subconscious mind is going to peel back, especially during an ayahuasca journey. And what's there, you're going to see, you're going to have to confront. And with ayahuasca, it's going to be probably rubbed in your face too. And that's part of the healing. And it's very liberating to go through that, the dark night of the soul, and to come out on the other side of that. Microdosing is not that. Typically, I'd say 80 to 90% of my clients microdose in the 100 milligram to 300 milligram range. And people that are more
psilocybin. Sorry, because I know you coach on several substances, several medicines. So I want to be sure we're clear here. We're not talking about microdosing ayahuasca, which
psilocybin
is possible. Yeah, psilocybin. Okay.
Psilocybin mushrooms. Yeah.
How many grams again? Most
100 milligram to 300 milligrams. I'd say 80 to 90% of people fall in that. We do the Fadiman protocol where we dose on day 1, day 4, day 7, day 10, 13, and so on. So basically 3-day cycles. Day 1's a dose day. We feel a little bit lifted. Day 2, people often feel even more lifted. It's called the transition day. And day 3 is you go back to normal and you start the cycle all over again.
Excellent. Okay. That is really, really interesting.
And perhaps the conversion might be noted here that it's, you know, 100 milligrams of psilocybin mushrooms dried is equivalent to 1 milligram of psilocybin, of actual active psilocybin. So there's additional, that's the conversion that we're work off. Best guess is that for a gram of psilocybin mushrooms, there's going to be 10 milligrams of active psilocybin. That's my understanding.
I am with you now. Thank you for that clarification. Okay,
awesome.
I had another listener ask, and I believe this one is about more of like a hero dose. So into actual grams, out of the milligram zone. Is it, if it is a bad experience, is there a way to come out of it faster than normal? Is there an escape button, basically?
I don't encourage that because I think that you have to feel what you have to feel. And when you make that commitment, you're on the roller coaster. You can't get off the roller coaster. Sorry. There are people that say that Xanax that could potentially help to mitigate that high and yeah, but it's, you make the commitment, you're going to feel all the feels, make sure you're in a safe, supported environment. Set and setting is so huge here. If you're doing a high dose, perhaps have a sitter, somebody who's sober, somebody who can remind you that this too shall pass, remind you that this was a conscious decision, remind you to breathe, remind you that the police are not breaking down the door right now. And that again, this too shall pass.
Someone wants to know, do antidepressants or certain medications interfere with the effects of psychedelics?
Yes. There's a lot that we don't know about this for obvious reasons. I don't think that the pharmaceutical companies want people to know much about the titration process or discontinuation process or how this could negatively affect our sensitivity to other potential medicines, psychedelics in question here. I've seen that, yeah, the people that have been on pharmaceuticals for a very long time, that can dull and dampen the effect. Typically, a larger dose, a larger microdose might be needed. And yeah, it is a concern. I've even had recently of, you know, a veteran who'd been through the VA and had an enormous amount of medications. I was on 20 some medications and he was a non-responder. Let's just say that. And that was really disconcerting to see that and to see, whoa, this is a powerful medicine that reliably works. Anxiety is another contraindication here. Is if people's anxiety are stronger than their depression, then that could be a potential contraindication. It's going to exacerbate that and it's going to force people's hands to actually act on what they're ruminating on. And if they're not ready to engage that, that's going to be a lot more fiery rumination. And if you're not ready to back that up with action, that's not going to be a fun time either.
Have there ever been any ER visits or severe adverse reactions? You just said that your client was a non-reactor. Have there ever been any bad things that have happened because of a microdose or a big dose?
Microdosing? No. That's the beauty of microdosing. The risk profile is so low. If it doesn't resonate with you, you just stop. We're really on the shallow end of the pool, the conservative end of the pool, and there's nothing to worry about from a microdose standpoint. At least I haven't seen that. From a macrodose standpoint, yeah, that's a risk that needs to be accounted for. That these experiences can be really, really deep. Again, 4 to 6 hours of the curtains of your subconscious mind peeled back, and there can be a lot of deep heartache and pain and, you know, repressed traumas that come up. And yeah, again, making sure that you're doing this with a guide or you have a sitter or you're at, if you're doing it in a retreat, make sure that it's a trusted retreat, that you have a firsthand recommendation of these holders, especially if you're a woman that is embarking on this path. Sexual assault does happen. I hear about that from time to time in Central and South America. You're in a very vulnerable position where you're doing this medicine and you're opening yourself up to our deep wounds and healing and are in a very suggestible position that can easily be taken advantage of, unfortunately. And that does happen. There's shifty players in the space. Yeah.
Can people who are allergic to mushrooms participate in microdosing or in hero doses?
of mushrooms?
I would say that somebody who's allergic to psilocybin should pursue LSD. That the data for Dr. Fadiman's Citizen Science, he's got, I believe, over 2,000 reports from 51 countries, ages 21 to 94, shows that there's no statistical significance between psilocybin and LSD. Psilocybin, we might be a little bit more in our emotional body, and LSD a little bit more in our head, a little bit more analytic. But yeah, if you're allergic to mushrooms, there's a couple other things that people can do. They can make the psilocybin microdose in tea form, and that sometimes can cook away the chitin. I think there's molecules within the mushroom that are really hard to digest, and some of us have adverse nausea. Typically not with the microdosing, but with the macrodosing, yeah, it can be pretty gnarly on your stomach. And so making a tea or the lemon, lemon teching is something that people are doing, and the pH of the lemon gets the psilocybin to be more aligned with our gut microbiome.
Wow.
Kind of an interesting thing that some psychonauts figured out in the last few years. Like, hey, if you just have a bunch of, and it makes sense. Like, hey, yeah, you shift the pH of the psilocybin, and it's, if it's more aligned with our gut, then we're going to have less of a challenge digesting it.
Oh my gosh, that is fascinating. Okay. Oh man, we're running out of time. I just have a couple quick, I'll try to make them quick for you. Do you recommend a certain scaling when it comes to plant medicines, like weed and then shrooms and then ayahuasca and then LSD and then whatever? Like, is there an order, or is it just whatever calls to you?
They're all tools. So there is no particular order. They're tools to deploy for a given need, and they all have a different plant spirit or an impression that they yield or impart. The plant spirit of ayahuasca is reported to be a motherly, grandmotherly energy. You don't get what you want, you get what you need. It's that tough love from your mom. I always say that the plant spirit of psilocybin is the mischievous little sister, playful sister. So it's like, that's a different energy than that stern mother. Again, LSD is going to be more analytical, more visionary. It's thought that a third of our C-level Silicon Valley executives are microdosing, I believe mostly LSD, for their boost in cognition and to envision and to ask the tough questions that don't have clear answers and ask the outside the box questions all together.
And to make sequels to Willy Wonka naturally.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes.
Okay. I have a friend who has been on a spiritual journey for quite some time, and she attributes parts of that growth and the difference between her growth and her husband's staying the same as to the reason why they are now separated. Can you make any recommendations for couples who are, maybe one is wanting to go on this spiritual journey and heal, and maybe one is just not quite there? How can individuals pursue their growth while still maintaining togetherness as a couple?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't know if I have a clear answer for that. And that does happen where people are doing this brave inner work. They've thrusted themselves onto a growth path and their partner is on a fixed path. And that's going to create distance. And their values have shifted. Generative drive comes to mind. That's a term that is so important that we find mate in a partner that has a similar drive. That's from Paul Conte, a medical doctor who's an esteemed therapist. From a practical standpoint, I look at vulnerability as a superpower for the world that we're shifting into. So that's going to be helpful for people speaking from the heart about their needs, about their boundaries, and the hope that their partner will keep pace. And where someone is thrusted on this path, they have this vision of a different world, of their place in it, and motivated, and their values have shifted. And again, their partner is stayed put. And that can be very, very problematic.
I mean, I think it kind of speaks to, again, why you should have someone like you kind of in the mix of it, to help guide with integration and not become so woo-woo that they're no earthly good, as we said in the very beginning. So tell people how they can participate in your coaching program, in your Zoom calls, and definitely where they can get your book.
Yes. Thank you, Meredith. I can be reached on Instagram at Worth the Fight Book. And my website is worththefightbook.org. On my website, there's a link to the Psychedelics and Limitless Personal Growth Meetup that I host. I host a Microdose Monday meetup every single Monday at 7 p.m. Central, where we go over best practices around microdosing. It's a wonderful opportunity to learn best practices from me, but then also to learn from our community of other people that have gone ahead and had the journey and that are at different stages of the journey and that are sharing their wins, their losses, challenges, et cetera, what's working for them. And it would be great to see people come out and engage our community.
Awesome. Well, thank you again. This was fantastic.
Thank you, Meredith. Keep up the great work. This is wonderful having this time with you.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, you'll also like the one I did on the more academic side of this conversation. It was with a clinical psychologist and professor at UAB researching psilocybin as a cure for addiction. It's episode 160. Stay tuned next week when I talk with a sex trafficking survivor who is now a lawyer bringing complicit organizations to justice.